on RN, online or via podcast. Hello, I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for joining me for Big Ideas. In the age of FANG, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix and Google, how can small players like Australia sustain their cultural identity? Professor Julianne Schultz explains why the age of FANG is profoundly different to anything we've known before. She discusses the cultural industries, their importance and potential, and says if we're to become more than just a marginal content provider, the idea of Australia needs to be refreshed and revisited. A key component of any revival, she argues, is our cultural institutions. Professor Julianne Schultz is the founding editor of the Griffith Review and chair of the Australian Film, Television and Radio School. The title of her recent 2016 Brian Johns Lecture, Cultural Institutions and Ideas of Australia in the Age of FANG. Brian Johns was a respected and influential figure in the Australian media landscape. In the 1960s, he was chief political correspondent for The Australian and Sydney Morning Herald. He then went on to become publishing director for Penguin Books Australia, chair of the Australian Broadcasting Authority, managing director of SBS, and then the ABC. Let's now head to SBS in Sydney for the Brian Johns Lecture, presented by Macquarie University's Centre for Media History. Your speaker, Professor Julianne Schultz.
Thank you very much. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great honour to be invited to deliver the second annual Brian Johns Lecture here tonight, the first since his death on the first day of this year. As others have already noted, this week should have been when we celebrated his 80th birthday, but sadly, that was not to be. Instead, I would like to take this opportunity to seek to apply some of his insights from a life devoted to expanding and enriching the idea of Australia and apply them to the new cultural world order. We now live in the age of FANG, the shorthand term for the new global era dominated by the oligopoly of Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, Google and others. These companies have made globalisation real and personal thanks to the intimate objects we carry with us and access many times a day, unwittingly transmitting digital data like dead skin cells all the time. It's particularly appropriate, as others have mentioned, that this lecture be delivered at SBS. Brian loved his time here as managing director. Its mission had been close to his heart since the earliest days of its imagining when he'd worked for Prime Ministers Whitlam and Fraser, a period when most of the national cultural institutions we now take for granted also came to life. Although many think that multicultural Australia was a post-war creation, Brian knew from his childhood in far north Queensland that it had far deeper roots. Growing up there, in the part of Australia the British Medical Journal had once declared a place unfit for the white man, an observant boy could not have helped but be aware of its rich and diverse history of human settlement. From descendants of the Indigenous nations who had seen off Dutch explorers hundreds of years before Captain Cook sought safe harbour in the town that now bears his name, to the settlers drawn over the previous 80 years from China, Germany, Italy, Ireland, the British Isles, and even Russia. Far North Queensland was multicultural before the word was invented. Indeed, a Russian physicist born in Atherton won the Nobel Prize for Physics in the early years of the Cold War. Far North Queensland was also poor, hot, remote, and lushly beautiful. A unique environment, most enduringly captured at the time by artists and writers. Ray Lawler in Summer of the 17th Doll, the Australian answer to Death of a Salesman, by Xavier Herbert in his great opuses, and in the paintings of Ray Crook and Ian Fairweather that we still celebrate. When Brian arrived at SBS, he was steeped in the quest to develop and communicate the many layers of the idea of Australia. He was an advocate of the importance of telling the full range of Australian stories, of finding, developing and nurturing the talent to do so, reaching citizens here and audiences abroad. He was not alone in this. Indeed, as I'll try and explore later in this talk, the movement to tell distinctive national stories, to emphasise the cultural dimension of national identity, was not unique to Australia. It was a movement that found expression all around the world in the post-war years, a period which produced great works of art, screen, music and literature, and in the process fostered a distinctive sense of belonging. We are now in a new epoch, and again facing the challenge of how this might be done. In the age of FANG, we need to find persuasive and creative ways to answer those who argue that the national and the local are just window dressing. We're all global citizens now. But everyone still comes from somewhere. That is part of the reason why we need strong national cultural institutions, not vulnerable defensive ones, to enrich our own and the world's diversity. Immediately before arriving at SBS in Milson's Point, Brian had been a transformative publishing director at Penguin. There he had championed literary fiction, immersive non-fiction, and found new ways and authors to write about history, culture and current affairs. He had a distinctive style that endeared him to many, as Bruce Sims captured so beautifully in his recent essay for Sydney Review of Books. It was a very successful time for the ambitious Australian branch of the British firm, a period in which many of the household names we now read today got their start, a time when Australian authors first published here began to make an impact internationally, and the Australian publishing industry really came of age. At the time, though, even the most successful Australian books sold only in the tens of thousands. A rare blockbuster might reach into the six figures. Those in the business took comfort in the certainty that numbers alone were not a measure of, or a mark of success or impact. So when he arrived at SBS, Brian was accustomed to the discipline of sales, to the importance of watching the numbers, of being aware of the interests of readers. But still, the relentless metrics of television came as a shock. Years later, he used to love to tell the story of how, on one of his first days at SBS, he was given the ratings from the previous night. Several SBS shows were marked with an asterisk. What does that mean, he asked. Less than 40,000 people watched the program, he was told by a somewhat nervous executive. Well, that's not so bad, he said. Coming from the world of publishing, 40,000 would have been an instant bestseller. But in TV land, it literally didn't rate. So it's all relative. There is, as we know, a difference between noise and influence. Controversy doesn't necessarily indicate lasting impact, especially in the world of popular culture, which is by its nature topical and often ephemeral. But in the heat of the moment, it's sometimes difficult to tell them apart. This is particularly apt in the age of FANG. The numbers that attach to the most popular items that whiz around the globe in an instant are truly remarkable, exceeding even the wildest dreams of the gatekeepers of the age of mass media. Millions of views, shares and likes, followers counted in the hundreds of thousands and then multiplied. This is an almost unimaginable world away from an asterisk on a ratings chart or the tally of a bestseller in one country. Digital disruption has become the new cliche that is supposed to capture this phenomenon, but it is inadequate. It suggests that what is happening is just the latest technological change, albeit one that has created a new class of self-interested global consumers, fostered remarkable new businesses, transformed or trashed old ones. The speed is unprecedented and the reach is without parallel. But technology has been transforming business and by extension the way people live ever since the Industrial Revolution. This, however, is different. What is at stake is more profound, with implications that encompass but go well beyond the commercial. The speed and reach of the technology these companies deploy now challenges the mechanisms of public administration, regulation and taxation that have been refined and developed over a century or more. They may in time even challenge the fundamentals of the nation-state itself. In the past, great realignments like this were the outcome of war. So far, this has been avoided, fortunately, but the tension between the global and the local is starting to play out in unpredictable ways. As the British scholar Martin Moore recently noted, democratic societies don't understand the phenomenon of the tech giants. What the phenomenon might mean in civic terms, what benefits it might bring to governance, and the dangers inherent in it. Most importantly, as scholars are beginning to draw out and people are feeling in their bones, this disruption is not just about technology. It is cultural and political. Although we haven't yet got our heads around what it might mean and how it might play out, you can see it in the Brexit debate in the UK, in the Trump rallies in America, and in authoritarian responses in China and India. What we do know, though, is that technology companies have figured out how to make money in an unprecedented way from the marriage of technology and culture. As a result, we're seeing a massive redistribution of wealth from the cultural sector, where meaning is created, to the technology sector, which has figured out how to market, distribute, reach, and make money in ways that the cultural industries never imagined possible. Now in the age of FANG, there are a handful of global companies shaping tastes, distributing and exploiting information we didn't even know we generated. In the process, they're creating a new world which provides unprecedented wealth for some, yet which gives us enough of an illusion of choice and of being in control to feel that we are free agents, global citizens, out on our own in the world. It's hard to think of historical precedents. The new oligopoly exceeds the control and reach of the East India Trading Company. Even the grandest colonial empires did not manage to secure such willing and active participation. The international reach that characterises the companies at the heart of the age of FANG dwarfs even the ambition and scope of the American monopolies of the earlier 20th century that built that country before antitrust laws constrained them. You could say that each of these epochs collapsed, but it took a long time for regulatory mechanisms to define and assert the public interest. What makes this different to, say, the rise of multinational firms in the middle years of the 20th century, the great corporations that sold energy, transport and consumer goods, that were led by engineers and accountants, is that culture and the art and craft of making meaning are at the heart of these new corporations. The old technology companies only really sold machines and systems, software and business solutions. They are still there, but have been displaced on the league tables by the biggest and most influential, those that intrude in the most intimate areas of our lives. The new mega profitable firms that make their billions by capturing and creating meaning and belonging from personal information, news, video, copyright, education, music, and the information that is the sinew of everyday life, directions, health, banking, shopping. Theirs is an enterprise which is as much cultural as it is technological. Some would argue that no one saw this coming, but that's not strictly true. While the particularity of a Facebook, Google and some of the others was not foreseen, the notion that content would be king has been around for a long time. More than 20 years ago, the Keating government appointed Brian to chair the Broadband Services Expert Group when the internet was but a shadow of its current form. Thanks to the Brains Trust that made up that group, Brian applied what he knew about the importance of cultural products to an imagined new environment. The questions in his mind were, what would it mean when information became the raw material of the new economy? How would content evolve to suit new mediums and platforms? How could access be guaranteed for all? It's fair to say that the technological future BSEG imagined was filled with content like the products the experts on the group had always known. Books, films, TV shows, music, games, creative works imagined and produced by writers, producers, composers, artists, designers and others, with new forms of distribution. This has now been supplemented by the rich loads of data drawn from the underlying building blocks of life in the capitalist 21st century. Personal information and history, networks, photos, preferences, purchases, location, movement, causes, and other atomised digital data that we are not aware we are shedding like dead skin cells. So the prediction that content would be king has proved to be true, but the role of the creator of that content has proved to be somewhat more precarious than anticipated. as we saw in the Productivity Commission's draft report on copyright. As a result, support for sustaining, growing, and exploring cultural identity is also more valuable, but more fragile than those who came of age in the middle of last century could ever have anticipated. Facebook's 31-year-old founder, Mark Zuckerberg, is alert to this. Not surprisingly, he takes a different perspective. He explained the risk to the 2,500 developers who paid $595 each to attend Facebook's F8 conference recently. And they heard him deliver what was described as more like a State of the Nation address than a keynote speech. He warned of the danger of people and nations turning inward against this idea of a connected world and community. It takes courage to choose hope over fear, he told them. We might nod in agreement if we think about China at its most authoritarian, but what about an open place like Australia? Do we run the risk of becoming invisible, of losing our moorings? Is that the price of embracing fear, hope over fear? As Zuckerberg said, we've gone from a world of isolated communities to one global community, and we're all better off for it. Certainly Mark Zuckerberg and his shareholders are a great deal better off for it. And arguably, so are many of the 1.6 billion people who regularly use Facebook. Just pause for a minute. 1.6 billion people use a service that was invented 12 years ago. That is significantly more than the population of China or India, more than the total number of Muslims in the world, more than North America, Europe and Japan combined. Content is the glue that brings people back to Facebook. The personal stuff, the photos, the articles, the video, the news, the music. It also means that there are fewer and fewer reasons to leave. In the last 3 months of 2015, Facebook generated revenue of $5.8 billion and last week reported a first quarter profit for this year of $1.5 billion. That's profit, all in the universal American dollar, in 3 months. It's little wonder then that the F in FANG stands for Facebook and includes its rapidly growing services like WhatsApp, Instagram, and its free internet service in 37 developing countries, where the provision of national infrastructure is being outsourced to a company led by a man born in 1985. The stock analysts who came up with FANG as a way of describing the companies who are at the heart of this new era were acutely aware that the list of the top companies had changed fundamentally over the past two decades. Where there were once energy, banks, pharmaceutical companies, there are now companies that, with the exception of Apple, Amazon and Google, did not even exist at the beginning of the millennium, with a couple of banks and energy companies just hanging in there. It's a remarkable tribute to the resilience and opportunism of American capital that this has occurred. There's no other country, with the possible exception of China, that can point to such a transformative renewal. For a reality check, look at our top companies. Banks, mining, insurance, a couple of former state-owned enterprises. The names and ownership may have changed, but the structure is, with the exception of the absence of News Corp now from the National Register, more or less as it was 20 years ago. There is not enough time to do a full analysis of the FANG companies and their role and significance, but it's important to provide a few numbers to sketch out why what is at stake is so profoundly different to anything we've known before. This is particularly crucial if we're going to be able to shape meaningful cultural and civic responses. Apple is the granddaddy of these companies. Despite recent slowing, I expect that it will go on doing what it's done so well now since it was founded in 1976, when it first produced stylish and functional devices that appealed to the cognoscenti. I bought them then and loved them. They used to call us early adopters apple seeds. And like all the best genetically modified seeds, we've gone on to produce an unrivalled crop. In our house alone, and there's only two of us, we have 9 devices that we use every day and 3 on reserve, just in case. In January, there were 1 billion Apple devices operating and communicating with the Apple Cloud. And more than 800 million people, the new global consumers, with an Apple iTunes account. Yet according to recent research by accounting academics from UTS, Apple paid tax in Australia at the rate of 1.2% of the billions of dollars of revenue it earned here, thanks to what in other circumstances would be regarded as a rather disappointing 3-4% net profit. For an idea of scale, for several years, Apple's revenue here has exceeded the combined sales of David Jones and Meyer. I prefer to spell FANG with two A's, so it's FANG. This is to include Amazon, which recently turned 22. Amazon did not take long to recognise that those who buy books were also likely to buy other stuff. Last year, 244 million of them did so. In many cases, Amazon knew what they wanted to buy before they did. It's a ruthless operator, the Walmart of the online world, but much more glamorous and ever so convenient. Amazon has relentlessly pushed prices down, squeezing publishing companies and their authors, using the power of its algorithms to make books virtually disappear or pop to the top of a wish list. In the trade book sector, it's estimated that Amazon accounts for about $250 million of the almost $1 billion worth of annual Australian book sales. It's worth noting that books by Australian authors account for about a third of all books sold here, but they would barely rate an asterisk on the Amazon list in its Seattle headquarters. Amazon isn't a flash company. It's focused on keeping costs down, profits up, and goods moving. And while global in its reach, it is another quintessentially American enterprise. I love America, but I think we need to have a dispassionate sort of analysis of how it works in this space. I had an interesting insight into this a couple of years ago. I met with one of the senior editors responsible for originating long-form essays for the Kindle, one of the Apple events, enterprises, in his cubbyhole office in a very unprepossessing building in Midtown Manhattan. After a fruitful conversation, he was a man very hard to get to, but we had a very fruitful conversation full of praise for the essays published by Griffith Review, which made me feel very good, and he told me that Amazon would be very interested in publishing the pieces we generated. The technical formatting was compatible, he said, and that was often a hurdle with others. There were just a couple of issues we'd need to sort out. First, we'd need to Americanise the essays, preferably with American examples and locations. There's no point in me saying, look, we Australians are quite happy to read stories about obscure American towns. People are people. Does it really matter if it's Des Moines or Brisbane? But I knew it was wiser not to ask that. The next condition was that Amazon would have to publish the essays first, and there would be no advances or guarantees about income or placement. Finally, as I prepared to leave, he said, we can work with either, but what's your currency? Is it the euro or the US dollar? Somehow, I didn't think it was going to be worth the effort. We'd remain wrapped in the bandages of global invisibility. N comes next, and Netflix, the company that spectacularly made the transition from renting videos and DVDs to streaming and generating global content. The convenience, the ease, the choice, and at its best, the quality of the long-form television series that pin you in your seat, hitting the button for the next episode before the last one's almost finished. There are more than a million people in Australia whose credit cards are debited $11.99 each month from Netflix Los Gatos CA for their subscription. There are virtually no Australian employees, and the only Australian content is recycled programs, often under a different name. So Utopia, the wonderful working dog production, has become dreamland. This week, you'll be pleased to know that there were two other Australian features. Restaurant Australia, season one, and that old favourite, Yindi the Lost King, the Lost Koala, a 1996 documentary about a baby koala that was injured in a car accident. I assume it recovered. We know that the American screen industries have always been ruthless, charging top dollar or dumping product, depending on what the market will tolerate, vertically integrating the distribution chain to the disadvantage of local filmmakers in Australia or Mexico or Europe or wherever, taking state subsidies wherever they can find them, and remaking the best ideas with American accents and locations. With this comes alertness to opportunity and ideas, an admirable trait. The most striking example of this approach I am aware of is the new series The Crown, which Netflix describes on its site as an American series, albeit one that is being made in the UK, with multi-pound budgets for each episode and much of the best British talent of a generation. Thanks to the Downton Abbey effect and the love affair with the British upper class in US and China, the number of episodes of The Crown keeps growing. Initially, it was to be 10, but at last count, it had expanded to 6 series of 10 episodes each. Whether the real Queen lives or dies, the series will go on forever, maybe like the monarchy itself. Meanwhile, the British government recognises the economic value of culture, invests in it and takes it seriously. The Crown ticks many of the British boxes for cultural investment: jobs, infrastructure, image, money, and an essentially British story that will soon be on billions of screens. Rather better than koalas or cooks, which seems to be where we are stuck, but maybe that's the next challenge for the Utopia Dreamland crew. Finally, the silent G in Fang. Google is ubiquitous, which in itself is a remarkable corporate achievement. It only emerged in 1998, and last year reported earnings, again in the universal US dollar, of $75 billion, and a gross profit of $48 billion. In many ways, it's the glue that holds all this together. In the course of writing this speech, I must have made 30 or more Google searches. It accounts for 89% of global searches, even more in many countries. You can get much more between 89 and 100. Its video streaming service is responsible for about 2/3 of desktop video watched on devices everywhere. A few years ago, Google heroically digitised 20 million books for a grand Google library without the approval of authors or publishers. Fair use in an information marketplace, the American courts decided. And that is just the start. There is, of course, a big paradox at the heart of all this: the way that global monopolies are able to sell themselves as enablers of greater consumer choice. In Australia, we're more committed to free trade than most. We want to believe in the level playing field, in the opportunities to trade, and we've done pretty well out of it. But it works better, I think, probably for minerals and agriculture than for services and cultural products, as we will see as the copyright and IP debate unrolls again in the next few months. Even though the global cultural sector continues to grow faster than any other segment of the economy, we still don't take it seriously enough in this country. To my mind, the Europeans are more clear-minded about what is at stake. Australian media companies grizzle about the impact of the FANG companies. Generally, they prefer to blame the public broadcasters and regulation rather than the global enterprises that are eating their lunch. It seems the TV networks are likely to see their licence fees for using the public resource of the airways reduced in the budget tomorrow night, which might well help their profits and their ability to withstand these companies a little longer, but it's unlikely to do much for extra content creation. European companies and regulators are much more adept at cultural protection and export. They get particularly agitated when they see their revenues streamed off to American companies, even if they have tax domiciles within the EU. European regulators have demonstrated that they're more willing to use legal and other tools to ensure a level playing field, protect cultural products, secure a local return, and reach international markets. So there are tax and antitrust, privacy and right to be forgotten cases against Google and the other FANGs still running in Europe. It's interesting to read the commentary about this. The New York Times reports these cases with meticulous detail, allowing the case to be made in the best tradition of disinterested reporting. But when you click on the link to the comments page, you see American exceptionalism in the raw. I consider the New York Times comment section by far the most mature and sophisticated. But when the news of the latest antitrust case against Google broke, the page lit up. Poor, sad old Europe. Time to get used to the steamroller of American genius. I was struck last year when talking to European media executives about the clarity of their vision of why this mattered. Sure, there was the commercial dimension. If advertising income is growing, as it is, but 80% of it is going to Google and Facebook, that's a problem. If Google and Facebook and the others are not paying anything like the tax they should, that's a problem. But one of the oldest lessons of American business shows that they are not only tough, but always ready to find ways to co-opt the best ideas to neutralise the opposition, Again, an admirable trait. So there is the sweetener in Europe of the Google Digital News Initiative. 150 million euros to provide the opportunities for innovation in news, new ways of European storytelling. At the same time, of course, broadening and deepening the content pool, putting a gloss on one of the most spectacular global monopolies the world has ever known. The first tranche of 27 million euros was distributed in February. But across 23 countries with hundreds of organisations, it won't go far. This snapshot is, I think you'll agree, somewhat chilling. It goes some way to explaining why the age of FANG is quite different to anything those of us engaged in cultural exploration, production and participation have known before. It's true that the internet has made the long tail of information more accessible than ever. There is more, but most of it remains invisible most of the time. When the habits of human nature are combined with the algorithms designed to recognise patterns, it becomes inevitable that we increasingly go back to the same handful of sources. There is a long tail, but it's rather oddly shaped, more like a fat sausage with a tiny sliver of the intestine it was stuffed into dangling at the end. And it's in that sliver that most of our cultural product resides, virtually invisible to the rest of the world and increasingly hard to find at home. Last year's report by Oxford's Reuters Institute showed that Australians were the most likely people in the world to use a digital device to obtain their news. Most strikingly, international sites accounted for two-thirds of this. It was tempting to explain this as a product of Australia's undoubted multiculturalism and outwards-looking nature. But I think really it was a testament to the power of the great English language sources, the BBC, New York Times, Guardian, and the other international news organisations that fill our Facebook feeds, pop up at the top of most Google searches. While our brands remain strong, Australians are increasingly going to the world for their news, information and entertainment. Being English-speaking is both a blessing and a curse. Canadians, Irish, Scots, New Zealanders all have the same challenge. How to remain visible and distinctive when living next door to a pushy, noisy neighbour. It's scarcely surprising that some of the most innovative and distinctive cultural products should emerge from countries who have their own language. The Netherlands, Germany, Denmark, Korea come immediately to mind. Their people may be effortlessly fluent in English, but with an additional layer that makes them unique and adds meaning at home and creates global opportunities. The big question is, how do we, with 24 million people living in an Asian time zone, respond? And what is the role of our cultural institutions in doing this? Before I attempt to answer that, I want to take a sidestep and trace the process of developing an idea of Australia that is culturally grounded, that is, more than koalas and celebrity cooks, much as we love them both. Understanding this is part of the process of trying to make sense of this new world order is important, because otherwise we risk operating with a cultural equivalent of Terra Nullius. Terra Nullius is a good place to start, because in recent years we've come to realise that the one thing that makes Australia truly unique, that is not replicated anywhere else, is being home to the world's longest continuous civilisation, one that is different in structure, tone and content to any other. This is now centre stage in Australian cultural engagement, though it still fails to be realised politically or economically. But it's a big step from where we were 50 years ago. It came as something of a shock to me recently to realise that, with the exception of the ABC, all the key national cultural institutions in Australia are only about 50 years old. Of course, there are the great state libraries and galleries and universities that were founded before Federation. But it took more than 60 years after Federation to create national cultural institutions. Certainly a sense of cultural distinctiveness was on the agenda in the 19th and early 20th centuries. It's there in the paintings, in the novels and the early films. But this was not captured and celebrated with national institutions until decades later. I was with a group of chairs of these institutions recently when I realised this. and I must say it took me by surprise. The chair of the National Library was explaining that they were about to celebrate their 50th anniversary. And then I realised that the National Gallery, the Australia Council, the Australian Film and TV School, one after another, CAL, Music Trust, many of these other organisations, others that have been fixtures in my adult life, are all younger than I am. The National Library, as I said, began its 50th celebrations last month, and more will follow in coming years. This reminded me that these institutions were created as a result of persuasive argument, gathering supporters and connecting with the public. Brian and his generation relentlessly pursued this. They wanted to look inwards and project out. The institutions, buildings and collections we now enjoy are a result of that advocacy. You see it in Canberra and in the great state arts precincts, and in the talent we've nurtured. They are both an expression and an enrichment of the Australian experience. These institutions are now facing the greatest financial challenges they have ever confronted. This is due to budget cuts, the rupturing of bipartisan political support, and the exclusion of culture from the innovation and comparative advantage agendas, even when a quintessentially cultural industry, education, is one of our biggest exports. With my Pollyanna hat on, this gave me an apple seed of optimism. If such a transformation could happen during the apparently dull years of the 1950s, maybe it can happen again. Maybe in an era when culture is more important and more profitable than ever, we can find a way to reinvigorate the cultural understanding of the idea of Australia. The creation of these cultural institutions was a product of the post-war world. If you take a long view, it's possible to see it as part of an assertion of national cultural identity that can trace its origins to the battle for American independence. In the 20th century, the dismantling of empires after the Great Wars created new urgency for expression of national identity in the post-colonial world. As we've been reminded recently with the wonderful documentary screened on SBS, the chaotic Irish Rising of 1916 helped create a template for the power of asserting cultural identity. It took a while in Australia. To varying degrees, political leaders understood it. Post-war mandarins like Nugget Coombs, following in the steps of John Maynard Keynes, recognised, in a way that I suspect would be alien to many in comparable positions today, that culture is as important as legal institutions, land, trade and people in creating a strong nation. A generation of writers, artists, editors and scholars who had seen the horrors of the war pursued this in little magazines, art books, on stage and radio. Brian was one of many involved in this during the 50s and 60s, and over the last year of his life, it was a privilege to listen to him describing some of the interpersonal and political dynamics of this movement to my son Carl as he researched the forces at play in the cultural moment that led to the creation of the Lucky Country. It's worth noting that News Corp, one of the greatest companies Australia has ever created, was also founded in this milieu. But that too is a story for another day. The result was the cultural architecture we now take for granted. The national institutions, the place where the material of being Australian is collected, curated and displayed, and the funding agencies which foster excellence and innovation and make it possible for skilled artists to tell old stories, imagine new ones on the page, screen, stage and canvas. For people of my generation, it created a sense of belonging and opportunities to explore, to see ourselves reflected back, to dig deeper into the forgotten layers, to try and make sense of place and time. But then something happened. The interrogations slowed down. No-go areas appeared. We stopped telling stories to ourselves, happy with the first version. The Aussie, 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 oi, oi, oi of the Olympics made us cringe, and the politically sanctioned history wars forced people into defensive positions. We stopped telling different stories and got stuck with a handful of tropes. Gallipoli, Ned Kelly, Eureka without the women, until Claire Wright came along, Bradman, and more recently, the 70s pop culture, Puberty Blues, Molly, Ita. No wonder young people hankered for a bigger global stage and felt somewhat embarrassed about being Australian, preferring to take their skills and education somewhere where they could be valued and challenged. Individual Australians are now conspicuous in film, music, television, media, theatre, design, fashion, architecture, all around the world. Our companies, however, are not. But if we are not to be a net exporter of creative talent, the country town that sees its best and brightest leave and never return, we need to make more effort. There are many more layers of stories to be told and explored. We need to find the songlines that connect the past and the present and share them at home and with the world. This is particularly important in a country that continues to welcome hundreds of thousands of new people every year, but fails to value the tales and experiences, warts and all, that have shaped us. In the age of Fang, this forgotten history, these neglected stories, risk becoming even more invisible, hidden on an algorithm that is almost never accessed, unless it pops up with sob stories about injured kangaroos. And as understanding of cultural identity weakens, it's easier for politicians then to cut the budgets of national cultural organisations if neither the economic nor intangible value is recognised. We saw this last year with the extraordinary and what I would describe as disrespectful cuts to the Australia Council, the swinging MyEFO efficiency dividends to the tiny budgets of the national cultural institutions, while at the same time the biggest agencies, to mention one, Defence, are not expected to find efficiencies, and the broken promises in relation to public broadcasting. But paradoxically, in the age of Fang, it's the cultural richness, the democratic, inclusive, pragmatic, egalitarian, highly skilled, educated and creative elements of Australia that makes us attractive and distinctive. More utopia than Yindi, the koala. It may even be a wellspring of innovation and agility, although it's yet to make the official list of the Prime Minister's talking points. Britain, which we still like to emulate, realised this some years ago and started investing in the cultural industries for economic and social returns. This year, that sector again grew faster than any other to generate just under 10% of British GDP. Last year, when the British Chancellor led a trade mission to China, culture was at the heart of the enterprise. We know that China's growth rate has slowed. We hear that all the time in relation to mineral exports and so on. But the cultural and creative industry sector of China is still growing at a modest 17% a year. So a group of British cultural leaders were in the advance party that the Chancellor took with him, setting up exchanges and new ventures, like the Chinese audience for the new Netflix series, The Crown. Yet, on the recent Australian-Chinese trade mission, cultural leaders and representatives, those from the cultural and creative industries, were conspicuous by their absence. The purpose of public investment in the cultural sector is not just the output, the galleries, the movies, the books written, the paintings and sculptures created and displayed, the shows staged, the music performed, but the outcomes, the building of capacity, sustaining citizens and civil society, fostering creativity, the creation of a sense of belonging, the projection of understanding, and the strengthening of a sector of the economy that already accounts for more jobs than mining or agriculture. Unfortunately, the economists who control the public policy agenda in this country have not learnt this from their forebears. They seem to think that culture is an optional nice to have, instead of one of the engines of economic growth, one that produces outcomes as well as outputs. So what is to be done to try and join the dots in the age of Fang? We need to become better advocates of the value of cultural investment. We need to redefine the purpose of this public investment. We need to find new ways to put the case so we can win political and bureaucratic supporters with hard-headed and sustainable arguments. We need to find new ways to embrace the particularity of being Australian in a global context and find new ways to express that. Cultural product has never been more valuable, and we need to find a way to earn our share from it. We need to be willing to challenge the market if it's not delivering, adding our voices to those demanding that the Fangs pay their taxes and not allowing them to unfairly distort the market. We need to be prepared to use legal and other means at our disposal to demand that laws are not broken. We need to use the leverage we have as the generators of 2% of global GDP to get returns and opportunities to participate that are our due. A digital news initiative here, for instance, or a major contribution to the digitisation of cultural assets without requiring us to give up the copyright. As the Australian talent around the world shows, we have something to offer that grows from our cultural wealth. We need to leverage 50 years of cultural investment to ensure that our stories are told not only to ourselves but to the world. If, as the scholars have identified, the dominant companies in the age of Fang have the power to command attention, communicate news, give voice, enable collective action, hold power to account and influence votes, we need that to be done on our own terms. This power needs to be institutionalised so that it can be civically accountable. The smartest fangs understand that playing a civic role brings extra kudos and wealth, just as the old newspaper companies understood that being the fourth estate gave them a privileged position. But for that to deliver anything good, there is a need for vigilance. Getting the settings of this institutionalisation will be a challenge. Getting the settings right will be a challenge in the next decade. It will require both the carrot and the stick. Some Americans are suggesting a royalty should be paid on data mining of personal information, as is done with the mining of minerals, and that levy returned to the country of origin. Europeans are challenging antitrust and privacy. The G20 is focusing on attention on tax to ensure that the wealth generated is spread appropriately and not left to a few rich dudes to distribute to their personal philanthropic causes. The market alone won't do this. We know from the process of creating cultural institutions that there's a role for the state, a place where, in the words of Robert Menzies, the future and the past can connect in the present. This is a time when they need to be stronger, better resourced and more innovative than ever, not defensive and vulnerable. Even in this rapidly globalising age, the nation state remains the best organising principle we have. We should not be ready to give up on it yet. I'm not alone in feeling uneasy about the proposition we should give it over to the new oligopoly that is present at every moment of our lives. Finally, to go back to the lesson from Brian's observation about the SBS show that rated an asterisk. As a nation, we need to take this seriously now if we are not to become an asterisk. The purpose of cultural investment in the age of Fang needs to be restated, funding maintained and opportunities to innovate and export enhanced. Otherwise, we will become invisible at best and tribal at worst. If that happens, we will be reduced as citizens and countries to passive consumers in a digital marketplace that values us only by our ability to pay. Thank you.
Professor Julianne Schultz, Chair of the Australian Film, Television and Radio School and founding editor of the Griffith Review, delivering the 2016 Brian Johns Lecture, presented by Macquarie University's Centre for Media History and supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund. Our thanks to our hosts, SBS and SBS Radio Operations, for supplying the audio.
Want to hear about the best party in town this election season? It's a new podcast with me, Fran Kelly.
And me, Patricia Carvelis.
The Party Room, your essential guide to this federal election. Subscribe now. Simply search for The Party Room in your podcast app.
Or listen via the RN website, abc.net.au/RN.